Welcome to Jam Live, the show featuring concerts and events presented by Junction Arts and Music Society in Haines Junction, Yukon. I am Maria Leniak. The Kluane Mountain Bluegrass Festival, going strong since 2003, has brought some of the finest artists of bluegrass music to the Yukon. Amazing musicians such as the Abrams Brothers, Michael Cleveland, and the Gibson Brothers. Jam Live was there again this year to record more outstanding performances. But wait, there's more! Jam Live also gets backstage for rewarding interviews with the artists. As in most musical genres, bluegrass is colored by the musicians' personal and professional lives, so we invite you to come along with us as we explore some of this behind-the-scenes background. And who better than Steve Gedros, past producer of this bluegrass festival, to chat with three of the five-member band Nothin' Fancy from Virginia. They formed in 1994 to compete in a bluegrass competition. Since then, they've grown in popularity, releasing 11 full-length albums and continue to perform at festivals across the United States and internationally. Nothin' Fancy is known for their smooth vocal blends, stirring performances, irrepressible humor, and for cruising the highways in their beloved bright yellow tour bus. Although, for their trip up to the Yukon, they turned fancy. They traveled by air. Now sit back and enjoy the following conversations with Mike Andes, Chris Sexton, and Caleb Cox, recorded in the quiet calm of the library at the St. Elias Community School in Haines Junction on June 11th, 2016.
Now this old road is getting narrow and nighttime is falling. There's not a sight that I can't.
I'm Steve Gedros, and we're coming at you from the Kluane Mountain Bluegrass Festival here in downtown Haines Junction, Yukon. I'm with members of Nothin' Fancy today, and I'd like to thank you guys for taking the time to speak to me today. Welcome to the Yukon.
Thank you, Steve. It's our pleasure to be here.
Yep, appreciate it.
Let's begin by having you identify yourselves and what your role is in the band.
I'm Chris Sexton, and I play the fiddle in the band, and right now, sometimes I sing all the parts, but only when I'm needed to.
And I'm Caleb Cox, and I play guitar in the band and try to sing tenor, and I also handle the bathroom cleaning duties on the bus.
Good man.
He does a great job. I'm Mike Andes. I play the mandolin and sing lead and have a great time putting up with these guys.
Tell us about the other members that aren't with us today.
The other members, Mitchell Davis is our resident banjo player. He lives in Lexington, Virginia. And Tony Shorter is our resident bass player, who also lives in Lexington, Virginia. They're on R&R this weekend, and we have some great fill-ins. When it comes to, you know, Mitchell Davis and Tony Shorter, you got to really search to find somebody qualified to take their place. So we're very fortunate this weekend to have Marshall Wilburn play bass with us, and Chris Wade is playing banjo with us, is filling in, and the guys are really doing a great job. We're having a great time.
Marshall's been before, so we're familiar with his playing. He's a wonderful bass player.
He is actually able to kind of fill me in on what was going to be happening up here, so that was a good
helpful
move.
Great. Okay, thanks for that. Before we get rolling, I just wanted to congratulate you on your induction into the Virginia Country Music Hall of Fame. That is a huge honor. There's a lot of great bands from there, so congratulations.
Thank
on
you
that
very much. That nice is a very nice honor, and looks good on the resume.
Does awesome it ever? Oh, yeah.
Wonderful. Yeah.
Does it ever? Okay, now I've read a little bit about this, but maybe somebody can tell me how the name Nothin' Fancy came to be. It looks to me like Mitchell was in a country band by that same name. Is that correct?
He was prior to us. And actually, the way the name came about, we were in line to enter a contest in Cremora, Virginia, okay, which is the home place of Mack Wiseman.
Okay.
They had the East Coast Country Music Championship, and I think it was 1994 that we were lined up there to enter this contest, and we'd filled out the application, and we were handed it in, and the lady said, well, you didn't put a name on it, and we didn't have one.
Right.
So we kind of looked around at each other, and Mitchell said, well, you might as well call us Nothin' Fancy, and she wrote it down, and we won basically thing that we had entered. We won the band contest and the instrumental contest, and the name stuck.
Right.
I think it's
a brilliant name for a bluegrass band.
It really has been good for marketing. It really, I mean, it's a lot of times you have to, when you tell someone, they say, you know, what's the name of your band? And we say, nothing fancy. And they look at us kind of funny. And then you say, well, you really need to check us out. And it's kind of a neat marketing tool.
Great, great. Whatever does that, that's a huge help. Well, I know, Mike, you're one of the founding members, and you talked about this a little bit, but maybe you can talk about how Nothing Fancy evolved from the East Coast Bluegrass Band.
Well, you know, Chris and myself, we were involved. His dad played banjo in the East Coast Bluegrass Band, and I've known Chris a long time and saw him come up through the ranks as not only a classical violinist, but evolving into bluegrass because of his dad playing banjo. And Mitchell Davis was in the East Coast Bluegrass Band. And we just kind of got together with the original guitar guy, Gary Ferris and Tony Shorter, and kind of like a parking lot thing, jam session type thing. And we started realizing that we had a real good blend. You know, the harmony was real tight. We had a good feel on what music we liked as far as we loved the country gentleman's type music, seldom seen.
Of course.
Hot Rise, you know, all those bands back in the day. And it was fun. It really was. And we took the fun part of it and we sat down one night and said, guys, what do we want to do with this? And we all had the same ideas. We wanted to play music as a profession. And, you know, we said we're going to have to make a commitment. And we made that commitment that night as the band took off playing private parties, private events, and then getting a festival here and there. Guy Carawan was our original fiddle player in Nothing Fancy. He didn't want to travel as much as the rest of us did. So he kind of fell off the wayside. Chris come on board.
They operated as a quartet for a couple of years, and they kind of had me as a session player for the second and the third album. I came in for a couple sessions on the second album. I played about six songs, but the next album they had me on every song except for two, and one of them was an acapella, and the other one only had a guitar. So I'm like, well, I think I can see where things are going. So
yes.
So when they asked me if I wanted to make that commitment and be part of the band, I could see it going that direction. They were already having me play up here with them at gigs that they already had, little local gigs. And I'm driving, you know, two and a half hours to get to these things and thinking, you know, it's a long drive, but this could be the start of something interesting. And I was like, I'm getting paid to do this.
Yes.
I might not, you know, we'll see where it goes.
Right.
And let's see, 18 years later,
it's still going.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like I said, Chris and I and Mitchell could see a problem approaching by being in both bands, the East Coast Bluegrass Band, which I considered was my band at the time. And, we could just see that things were getting ready to come to a head. I mean, the East Coast Bluegrass Band, we weren't really one of these bands that was striving to become professional. We were playing private parties and not really the festival scene. And probably one of the hardest things I've ever did in my musical career was having to tell the guys in East Coast bands, like, guys, I don't like the word quitting, but
yes.
I'm moving on to nothing. And that's a funny phrase. I'm moving on to nothing fancy. And then Chris, you know, he's coming along board also. He's kind of evolving into it also. And Mitchell. So we kind of, the East Coast band, they hung together there for a little while afterwards. And, kept the name going, but Nothing Fancy has done what we wanted it to do. You know, we're trying to step up the ladder each and every year. Now we got Caleb on board, and that has really taken us a leap and a bound. You know,
excellent,
because he's a young'un. He's bringing the young age into us, and we needed that. We really did. You know, you can get complacent in what you're doing, and
in any field.
I mean, like I said, you know, we've been together since 1994, and all of a sudden you need a little shot in the arm to a little B12 or something there to wake you up. And Caleb is our B12 right now.
Even though Caleb keeps claiming he wrote "Sunny Side of the Mountain" back in 1952.
Did he? Oh, you're reincarnated?
It was in a former life.
Well, this kind of answers my next question.
That's his story, and he's sticking to it.
Okay, I'll buy that. This kind of answer, you already answered this question about the key to your success. I guess that's just you love playing together. Everybody has a similar view of how it's supposed to go and what you want to achieve. Is that kind of sum it up?
It does. And, you know, it's kind of rare, really. I mean, for five guys, I mean, you have five different personalities, but yet you have five guys that see the same goal and understanding, and we get along probably better than most families, to
Isn't
be honest
that great?
With you. We just talk about it each and every time we're on the bus. You know, we make a joke. We're one of the few bands that actually share food with each other on a tour bus,
yes,
you know.
And yes.
We like one another.
Yeah. So that is the key to
our
longevity. Is it?
You know how many times you read about a band split up due to artistic differences.
Oh, it's not artistic differences.
No,
they can't stand one another.
I think it's a personal
They cannot
thing.
Stand right. one another. Yeah. A lot of the times that's what it ends up being, but... you know, I can see artistic differences as a excuse for some bands breaking up, but you know, and we've had members come in and out since we started. But you know, when they've gone on their merry way, we've always wished them well, and a lot of them have gone on to some really awesome things.
My wife just reminded me of that the other week. Said, you guys aren't doing real bad. You know, Eli Johnston filled in for Tony 1 year.
Okay.
Yeah. And Eli is now with Doyle Lawson and Quicksilver. So that was a pretty good move,
That's
right?
That's top of the heap.
All right.
And then,
we
had Justin Tomlin, who was with us for about a year and a half. And then he left and continued on with the Deer Creek Boys with his brother Jason Tomlin, a.k.a. Sweet Tater from Junior Siskin Ramblers Choice.
Okay, I've seen him play, yes.
Yeah, they're Casey Ogden.
Isn't he the bass player?
Yeah, Jason's playing bass.
Yeah.
And then there's also, and Kayla was actually playing with the Deer Creek Boys for a little while when
played
we found him.
Bro.
But
okay.
The reason why we had to find Caleb is that we had Jesse Smathers, who was also with us about a year and a half. And he got an offer to play mandolin with the Lonesome River Band.
Okay.
So,
okay.
See, I mean, we're
what
not
are you going to do?
We're training some good musicians.
We're training.
Well,
them.
You should be proud of that.
Yeah.
Seriously. Yeah.
We've discovered these people.
Right. Right. Well, I was reading that back when the East Coast Bluegrass Band was going, you recorded your first album, and the studio was burned to the ground by lightning. It seems to me there's a song in there somehow.
Yeah, that'll come out in 2025.
Okay. That must have been a pretty traumatic experience.
Well, I mean, we weren't there in the studio, but
of course. The
traumatic part was we had just basically finished the album.
Right.
I mean, and it was all there, and we get a call, and our album is gone, but that's not the big picture. The studio is gone.
Right.
You know,
right.
And it was a wonderful studio. Right now I'm having a brain.
And, yeah,
the, what's the name of the studio?
Dubuchet.
Right. Yeah. There it is. Yeah, Tim Austin studio.
Okay.
And,
which he has since rebuilt. Is that
Aubrey
correct?
Haney, Aubrey Haney had several fiddles there that were lost in the fire.
No.
Yeah, there were several instruments there that it's like you can't replace them, and they burned up along with the DAT tapes and everything that they were using.
Yeah, like I said, it was, you know, our little portion of it was not the big picture, but the studio and everything, you know, was gone.
Wow.
Yeah.
And I know it was devastating to Tim, but he bounced back very resilient and a great guy.
Went in and re-recorded that material?
Yep.
Right.
And by that point, Mitchell had he used to play fiddle with East Coast, and then he had left the group, and so this is the funny thing. The guys said, okay, what do we do? We need a fiddle player to replace Mitchell, and I think everybody in the band had said, "Let's try Buster. Let's try your son out."
Right.
And my dad said that I would be too classical.
Oh
yeah, my dad didn't. Yeah, he didn't believe that I'd cut the mustard.
Right.
And then, yeah, I guess a couple of the guys had really leaned pretty heavily and just give him a shot. If it doesn't work out, it didn't work out. But you know, give him a chance. He's your son. And I come down there just. I mean, I might have been out of the conservatory for about. Maybe 2 weeks at most.
Oh, it's too, I
at,
see.
At most.
Okay.
So I'm coming right out of the shell of the classical training.
Yes.
And I come into the studio and the title track, Life's Mysteries, was the first song I recorded.
Right.
You can still hear how nervous I am. I sound
lots
nervous.
Lots of vibrato.
Yeah, very, 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 very like nervous vibrato. Like,
yes.
It didn't take us long. We got that out of him.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you know, I remember I did this one thing in the song, and everybody, including Tim Austin, just collapsed into a heap laughing. I thought,
What?
Oh my God, they didn't like it. And I said, was that good? And my dad comes back, that was great. yeah. And yeah, I, if my dad hears this, I'd, you know, of course he knows I do that impression lovingly.
Of course. Of course. I know that, you've recorded 11 CDs and the last with a couple of different record labels, but you released, By Any Other Name in 2015 with Mountain Fever Records. How have they been to work with?
They've been wonderful. It's been a good move for Nothing Fancy. Mountain Fever does a great job on promotion and great folks to work with. And we've got a song that's been on the chart now, the Love, War, and Games off of this album. It's been on the charts now for like four or five months, I believe. And so, yeah, it's a good move for Nothing Fancy. We had been with Pinecastle. Reckon they were good for us, and then we had moved from them to a smaller label, Virginia Dreams, and that was okay for us too, but we just needed to step back into the fire and get a little more promotion and get some people behind us, and I think that's what we've done.
Right. I see names like Junior Sisk, Alan Bybee, and Spinney Brothers on that label, who have all come and played our festival through the years, and of course Goldheart and Breaking Grass are label mates that are here this time, right? Well, that's great. Tell us how you hooked up with Aaron Ramsey, and he produced this latest record, I gather.
Yeah, he's kind of a mainstay there with Mark and at the studio at Mountain Fever. And, you know, we were asked, do you guys want to bring in your own producer, or who would you like to produce? And
so that was your call?
And, well, Caleb, you know, he was very familiar with Aaron and a lot of the albums. And
yeah. I'd worked with Aaron once before on an album that it was recorded at Mountain Fever Studio, but it wasn't a Mountain Fever release.
Okay.
But when I was there, I got to work. Aaron was the one calling the shots, so I got to be very familiar with his style, and I was like, yeah, I could work with him again.
Right, right.
And plus, he's got a great ear, and he knows how to. Mark Hodges actually said, you know, this is the guy that, you know, he knows what to listen for. He knows how to make a bluegrass album sound its best.
Okay.
Yeah, and anytime that you're working with a producer, if you're not familiar with the producer, you don't know what to expect.
Of course.
And you can actually build up some animosity, some fear going in.
Of course.
And that's not good. No. That's why we discussed it. And again, Caleb was my to-go-to guy, because he was, you know, he's played with all those guys down there, and he knew a lot about what was going on, the albums that were being produced by Aaron. And you can take it from there, Caleb. I mean, you was really high on him. And
Yeah, I'd heard a lot of, I'd gotten to pick with Aaron a couple times down at Galax at the Fiddler's Convention
right.
down there, and heard a lot of what he was doing. And he just gets such a huge sound out of a bluegrass band. Like, it's, you hear some studios will record a CD that might be good, you might have good instrument tones, but just sounds thin.
Okay.
And every record that Aaron puts out that he produces just sounds huge from the first note to the last, and it's something to get excited about.
Of course.
Especially for someone that doesn't know bluegrass especially well. You know, they don't know exactly what to listen for.
Sure.
In a given instrument, or, you know, the average person isn't going to say, wow, the guitar tone on that one break was great. You know, people just don't know, but they know when that music, when they kick off that first song and it just sounds as big as a house, that they're like, yeah, this is good.
Great.
And that's what Aaron does. So
great. He takes a pretty active role in what goes down.
When you go in the studio, he'll say, okay, guys, what song are you looking at recording? And he comes out into the room in the studio with us, and we rehearse the song with him before we ever get behind the microphone.
Okay. Yeah, he'll grab
and
a guitar,
he'll get his guitar
or a banjo
okay.
yeah. or something.
Yeah. And it's wonderful because he interacts well with us, and, you know, all of us go in there saying, you're not going to hurt our feelings if you hear something that you need to change or something that's going to add to the song.
Please tell us.
Please do.
Yeah.
And he's got a very tactful way when we're rehearsing a song. His eyes are closed, and he's just intent into that song. And when we get done, he's like, okay, I think what we need to do here is take that banjo and pull that back over here, put that guitar, you know. And the next thing you know, you have, like Caleb said, a huge-sounding song
wow.
that came in there as a little tin can of a song, you know. And that's an amazing talent.
That's a huge gift, isn't it, really?
And, you know, adding a different chord here.
Okay.
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
you know, or like with as the case was with the Last Train from Poor Valley, would you know when we finished playing it for him, it was like over 6 minutes long.
Right.
And so we got to cut that down.
Right.
I mean, and it's really our arrangement is really because we play it so slow.
Okay.
But you know, it has such a good feel to it at that tempo for us. And when we made his changes, not only was it under 5 minutes, but it was a completely fresh arrangement.
Isn't that?
And it doesn't sound like any other arrangement you'll ever hear of that song. And it's a song that's been done by, you know, really, really, of course, the seldom seen, mm-hmm. kind of brought it to the forefront. Okay. And there's Norman Blake himself who did the original cover.
Okay.
The original version of it because he wrote it. But, you know, all these cover versions, I love each and every one of them because it's a great song.
Yeah.
But what we brought to the table, if you're not going to do something new, then it probably shouldn't be done. And it was so new to all of us.
It's difficult mm-hmm. when you go into a studio and you have a cover tune that you want to record.
Of course.
You have to make it your own. You have to take it. You don't want to change the melody of it. You can't necessarily do that. But right. you have to do something to make that song your song.
Right.
And with Aaron's help, we have definitely taken a great song that the Seldom Seen do a great arrangement on, all these other bands do, but also now we've got a hold of it too. You know, you got fans come up, I love your version of Last Train from Poor Valley.
Wow.
Or you come up, somebody, I've heard Seldom Seen do this song all my life, and I love theirs, but I also love your version. So
wow.
that means a lot when you get that.
Very special. Yeah. Okay. I was interested to see there's a real mix of sources for this, how the songs come into the band. Mike's written some. Caleb's dad contributed in it, instrumentalist. Chris's dad.
Yeah.
Okay, that's a typo. Chris's dad. And Caleb sings a couple. So tell me about how material comes into the band.
Well, again, you got five different personalities, and we all come together on the bus. And when we're getting ready to go in the studio the end of June.
Great.
And we're picking material right now. And it's not that we sit down and have business meetings about songs. Just every time that we get together, you know, say, hey, guys, here's a couple that I've written. Listen to them. Tell me what you think. Caleb's got a few that he has written for this next album. Chris has written a couple songs that we're going to run through the course to see if it makes it on the album. We've been batting around some cover songs that some old classic country songs that's mm. never been recorded bluegrass. So it's kind of strange. It's almost like a hurricane of a hodgepodge at the beginning,
right.
just things being thrown everywhere.
Right.
And then as the funnel gets smaller toward the 27th, we will have a handful of songs to go in that studio to throw to Aaron and say, here's what we got right now. Let's
okay.
hear what we can do.
Okay.
And before we end that 3-day session, we'll have 12 songs picked for the album.
Okay.
It's one of those things that happens out of thinking that it's never going to happen.
Okay.
You know,
yes.
You know, we started
it
talking
looks like
about
chaos.
This.
And
it
then,
is.
Right,
exactly.
And I know every band works different on this particular subject. Some bands can sit down and pick a theme for an album and then search for a year to a year and a half to find songs that meets the criteria for that
train
theme.
Songs right. or whatever it is.
Right.
Yeah, sure.
We don't do that.
Okay.
I guess it's with God's help or the God of music that helps us. It all kind of comes together. You know, we don't necessarily sit there and this is how it has to be. This
yeah.
is the theme of the album.
Okay.
So yeah, everybody has a part in it. Like I said, I'm excited for this next album because I do want to hear it. I personally want, you know, a lot of original material.
Of course.
I want songs that's going to sound like nothing fancy. Caleb, like I said, he's got a couple that really caught me when he played them, you know, and he's kind of nonchalant about them. He's like, oh, here's one that I wrote, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, man, that is a really good song, you know. I don't want to swell him up too much.
No,
but
no,
yeah.
Of course not.
And Chris, he written a couple, he emailed them to me, and, you know, I heard it. I have not yet actually sat down and listened to it close enough, but I just heard it when it was playing. I thought, man, I like that. It's got a different beat thing to it, and I thought that would be really good for the album. So, again, he's got my vote to throw it into the mix. Again,
sure.
that doesn't mean it's going to make it.
It's going to make it, okay.
But it's going to be thrown in there. So I guess we really haven't answered your question.
No, you have. So do you go into the studio with arrangements in mind, with instrumentation and that kind of thing, or is it that all figured out in the studio?
Well, we go in, we'll usually run over the song. We'll come up with kind of a general arrangement. But when we go into the studio, of course, we've got Aaron, who is producing the record, so it's kind of up to him as well. So we go in there kind of open-minded, you know. Okay. We'll have an arrangement in mind that we'll work on, but we don't have to stick to that. We work on it constantly. And, you know, even in the studio, we'll record something, lay down a track, and be like, well, let's try this, and we'll take that, you know, erase that track and try something different.
Okay.
And so you might take four or five takes with four or five different arrangements and just pick what you like the best.
Okay.
It's amazing what you can do with...
Yeah. I personally look forward to the studio part of, I mean, having the song. I look at it as taking a file and filing off rough edges, you know.
Of course.
Again, we're on the bus and we're throwing a rough melody to a song that I've written.
Yeah.
I might write a song and think, man, this is the most beautiful thing I've ever written. Got a nice chord progression or whatever. But when I get it in the studio and amongst the guys and the producer, all of a sudden it becomes that much more than what I thought it was.
Isn't that interesting?
On this album, this last album, the song on there, what's the one I told you made me feel like a blanket going around me?
Oh, Silas Brown.
Silas Brown. Yeah. When I wrote the song, I thought, man, this is the best thing I've ever written, because I'm a woodworker, you know.
Sure,
I
yes.
wrote this song about an old man that was a carpenter. And it just had that real nice feel. And I'm thinking, man, this is cool. You know, we get in the studio, and these guys get to batting it around. He does a dobro thing on it, and Aaron said, let's try this, let's put this here. And all of a sudden they go in the studio, and I'm back there after we put the rhythm tracks and stuff down. And I'm like, it literally felt like somebody wrapped a blanket around me and said, you're warm now, Mike.
Wow. What a beautiful result.
Yeah, I was there, and he said that, and I had been thinking similar thoughts. I said, this is like being around a campfire at
right.
night. I said, I was like, I just summed it up like this. This song is made of warm.
Yes.
It's made of warmth.
Yes.
And that's just an example of, like I said, they have rough edges on them when they go in, even though you think it's the smoothest, but the producer will find the rough edges, the other guys in the band will find them, and they all just hone them down and smooth them up, and it works. It's an amazing journey. It truly is. Mm-hmm.
So typically, are these a bunch of songs that you have not played in concert?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're not touring these songs, figuring them out, and then going to the studio?
No, we very rarely... Sometimes we'll have a song that we do live on stage that we're going to bring into the studio, and normally that happens because of the fans. If it's a song we're doing live and the fans keep going to the CD table trying to find it, then that'll push us to record that.
Of course.
But some bands try a song out for a year before they try to get a feel what the audience thinks of a song. We basically throw it to the audience, you know, cold turkey. You know, we record it and... we don't wear it out on live before we record them.
Right, right. Now, it looks like a lot of you guys come from musical families. Let's just go around and talk about that, Mike.
Well, let's start with Caleb.
Okay.
I've been playing music for as long as I can remember, really. Both my parents played guitar. Mom, she always, as long as I can remember, I remember going around to different churches around where we lived, and she would sing. And then when I got older... We're old enough to, you know, probably six years old, I'd help her sing. You know, she would teach me harmony parts.
Right.
We would sing together, and then I decided I wanted to play, and I got a guitar for Christmas when I was 7, I think, and just play it all the time.
Okay.
Like, ever since then, I've played it all the time, and I've got 5 siblings. It's 6 of us total kids.
Right.
And my parents. And I was playing for a couple of years, and they decided, hey, we're gonna start playing too. So my brother Nathan, he picked up the guitar, and I switched to banjo. Then my brother James picked up the bass, and then my other two brothers, Luke and John, picked up the fiddle, and Mom switched to mandolin.
Okay.
And we started touring as a family band called Clearwater Branch, and we did that for, 6 or 7 years probably. And got really popular around the area. We played all around Virginia, North Carolina,
right.
and West Virginia a little bit.
Right.
And playing 5 or 6 days a week.
Oh, okay. So this wasn't a weekend thing.
No, no.
Okay.
No, we pretty much stayed gone all the time.
Right.
And we all started going different ways musically a little bit. You get to a certain point, you kind of lose the cute factor, you know, with all the kids. Everybody's getting older.
They're grown up
yeah,
now.
They're all grown up, getting ugly.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally get
myself
that.
Myself included. Yeah. So that's why I started looking for a little bit something different musically. And
okay. Is that when Jerry Douglas came along?
Yeah, yeah. Jerry had a lot to do with it.
How long is it going to be till you think we're ugly?
We're all already ugly. I've been mad for a long time.
Okay. Darn.
All right.
Well, you know, like it's interesting foreshadowing. One time we had a show in Madison Heights, okay. Right near where his family lives.
Virginia.
Yeah, okay. Madison Heights, Virginia.
Yeah.
And Caleb's, the Clearwater Branch was the opening act for
okay.
us.
Mm.
So we had actually met him and played music with him, and it just, I was like, well, that's cool. You know, an entire family like that
yeah.
playing music together. And, you know, I got to meet everybody, tell them, you know, he did a great job. And then we go on stage and play our show. But you never know who you meet at the time.
Sure.
You might meet him again. You might be working alongside him. Might be spending every weekend with him.
Yeah. Sure.
You never know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Chris, go ahead and give your background.
Well, my father picked up just about the time I was about to be born. He picked up the banjo.
Okay.
And he's got, you know, his dad played guitar. A lot of my grandfather's siblings played.
Okay.
And from all the family research we've done, you know, it's like there's been quite a few mandolin players and fiddle players even. And so the family's been playing music for a long time, but I come along and I have I grew up around bluegrass. I grew up around listening to my dad playing banjo. It's like I'm probably one of the few people that can be serenaded and lullabied and fall asleep to the sound of a banjo.
That is unlikely.
Well, it's what he had at the
yeah,
house.
Sure.
Okay, rockabye, baby. Yeah, it doesn't quite work that way.
Yeah.
You know. Thanks for painting that picture.
Yeah. But yeah, I grew up around the music. And I took up a violin at the school level. They offered string classes for fifth graders.
Great.
I was only about 9 at the time, but you know, I this is the craziest thing. The string teacher came in and demonstrated, her instruments. She brought out the violin, and I'm a big Star Wars fan.
Okay.
Huge Star Wars fan. And she played the theme music to Star Wars, and I said, I want to do that. I brought that flyer home, and I said, Mom, I want to take strings. And my mom was like, what got into you? You know, like, you never really were, you know, granted, my dad played, but
sure.
there was no telling that I had any musical ability or that I wanted to follow in that path.
Right.
But I was like, I want to do that. And then I took strings and I started getting more into classical music.
Sure.
And from there it took off. And it turns out on my mom's side, you know, I noticed once when we gathered together, we were at a church service and everybody in my mom's side of the family could carry a tune. I was like thinking, yeah, how'd they get to sing like that? They're singing like birds. Well, come to find out, my great grandmother's maiden name was Bach.
Oh, no kidding.
So there is
no
there,
kidding.
So somewhere there's wow. an Uncle Johann Sebastian
exactly.
out there.
Exactly.
Somewhere. And I haven't done all the genealogy, but I'm sure there's a link. Because the Bach family from Germany, that's a huge family and a very musical one at that.
Absolutely.
So,
well, JS himself had, I don't know, 20 kids or some huge number.
Yeah, he had 20 kids. Only 9 of them lived to be adults.
Adults, right.
But still.
But he had endless brothers and
yeah,
relatives.
All these brothers. And his father died when he was relatively young. He was raised by his older brother, I believe. So there's all kinds of musical background for me, but it's weird how many different sources there are. It's kind of,
isn't that interesting?
So where my mom and my dad met, that was the converging of two musical streams.
Isn't that interesting?
Apparently.
Well, do you think, one informs the other? Like, do you think your classical playing has, has helped your bluegrass playing, or is it an impediment? Yeah. I mean, obviously you have great technique.
The thing is, with some classical players, you can definitely tell, and I don't make any effort to hide that. And like, I'm not going to completely change the way I play just because I'm playing fiddle music, because I've never been one to think, you know, I've got to play sloppy to play the fiddle.
Right.
I mean, no one wants to hear sloppy fiddle playing. They want to hear good fiddle playing.
Of course.
But at the same time, you know, yeah, the knowledge of the technique, you know, just knowing how to do something. Well, I'll listen to a fiddle player do something, and I'm like, I want to do that. Okay, well, yeah, I know exactly what he's doing, and I can easily translate what I hear.
Okay,
so I it does help in substantial ways.
I can give you a prime example. When he came on board with Nothing Fancy, in the first couple of gigs we played out, he had perfect form as far as classical form. He stood perfectly straight. The violin was, you know, perfectly, you know, parallel, whatever it had to be. And he would play these wonderful breaks on these songs. But he didn't lean into the microphone. He didn't move much his body when he was playing. Everything was perfect. You know, it was like a machine, like a classical violinist in an orchestra.
Of course.
And he wasn't coming across real well to the audience.
Okay.
And I've never had any training in my life,
I was really surprised to read that, Mike.
Lessons of any form. But I looked at him and I said, Chris, I said, I don't know a thing about technical music, but I said, I'll tell you what, if you lean into that microphone and wiggle your rear end when you take that break, I said, this crowd will go crazy. Well, he was a little bit uncoordinated at the time. So you should have seen the first time that he leaned into the microphone and tried to wiggle his rear end while he was taking a fast break on the fiddle.
Yes.
The crowd went wild. So that's
no
it created a monster from that moment on.
I see.
Every
and
show,
you're responsible for that.
Well, but it worked. You know, there's a lot more to it than just the technical parts of it. Caleb can tell you. Caleb is the same way. He come on board with us and, you know, he's taking these tremendous breaks on the guitar, and I look over at him one time or whatever, and he's like holding the guitar way out beside him or something. You know, just goofy things like that. And the crowd goes wild.
Sure.
The other night, his microphone fell, like, instead of pointing toward the guitar, it all of a sudden was pointing toward the ground. Well, he just kind of fell to his knees and played the guitar upside down.
To the mic.
Yeah. And here you go. You draw the applause out of that audience. Whether they want to applaud or not, they're drawn to do it. And it's funny how that works.
Well, I remember you did something like that. Did something like that happen to you at a mandolin competition?
I won a contest one time because the mic stand fell while I was playing my break on the mandolin. And a lot of people would stop, you know, and said, I want to take my turn again.
Of course.
Not me. I just fell to my knees right with the microphone, and I continued on. And I won the contest. The break probably wasn't that good, but the show was great.
Well, it's a visual thing, right?
Exactly. It's entertainment, you know.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
And it's certainly a testimony to the show must go on.
Right.
Yes, yes. I was really interested to read that you guys have your own bluegrass festival or are involved with starting one. Is that correct?
No. This year will be our 16th.
16th,
We've been very fortunate. You know, we 16 years ago, we decided to host our own bluegrass festival. And it's been successful every year. And I think the reason for that is we did our homework. We toured for several years before we started having our own festival. So we had a fan base built up.
Right.
And I was just talking to a gentleman over here today about this. We draw people from all over the United States and Canada. Canada is supporting our festival very well. Got a lot of folks that come down to it. But we actually draw more people from away from our little town than we do from our little area.
Is that right?
It's kind of strange.
That's interesting.
You could ask the audience, though, you know, if you're from within 50 miles of Buena Vista, Virginia, raise your hand, and you'd be surprised how few people are there.
Wow.
But then you could ask, you can go around the parking lot, and over the course of the 3 days, there, you know, we've had up to like 3,000 people over the course of 3 days. And you can go around the parking lot and looking at license plates and just be humbled to see how far people have driven
and
to come to the
festival. There was a whole thing a couple of years ago. We had like this whole group of Irish tourists that came in and they sat and watched band after band after band. But there was one year, there was a band that came in that was from Sweden.
Okay.
A bluegrass band from Sweden. They were on their way down to the IBMA in Nashville, I believe. and we were a stopping point. They saw that our festival was going on. They stopped in and they asked if they could camp there and said, sure, you know. We actually had them play during the supper break.
Great.
And people people loved them.
Yeah.
And the incredible thing is you could understand every word.
Yeah. Is that right?
Yeah. But yeah, we are very honored to host our own festival. Let me go ahead and give a commercial for that right now.
Sure, please.
Ladies and gentlemen, coming up September the 22nd, 23rd, and 24th, we will be hosting the 16th annual Nothing Fancy Bluegrass Festival held in beautiful Buena Vista, Virginia.
Tell them about it, Mike.
At the Glen Murray Park, right there beside the beautiful Blue Ridge Mountains. And I don't know what the weather is like around this part of the country on September 22nd, 23rd, and 24th. But I can tell you what the weather is like in Buena Vista, Virginia. It is beautiful. It's nice and cool in the evenings, hot and warm and during the day, because it is September the 22nd, 23rd, and 24th. Got a great lineup of bands this year. Flat Lonesome's going to be with us again. Oh, my goodness. Got Balsam Range is going to be there. The Bluegrass Brothers. I believe the Moron Brothers are going to be there. Larry Stevenson and the Larry Stevenson Band's going to be there. Nothing Fancy will be there all week long. You get to hang out and visit and carry on with us, a bunch of boys. And
all those bands are there because they were all available on
September 22nd, 23rd, and 24th. You can also find more information about our 16th annual Nothing Fancy Bluegrass Festival if you'll go to our website. That would be... NothingFancyBluegrass.com. Check out September 22nd, 23rd, and 24th. Thank you, Steve.
Got it.
So
okay.
That could also be hashtag September 22nd.
Oh, I see. Okay. Okay. Well,
we haven't started a hashtag thing yet. I don't think so.
I think you just did.
Maybe you just did. I was interested to see that Jeff Scroggins in Colorado have played there.
Well, actually, yeah, they're
Flat
coming
Lonesome,
this year.
Balsam Range, Junior Sisk, all bands that we've had up here, and Spinney Brothers. That's really fun because we're kind of personally familiar with these folks.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, and we're very excited about Spinney Brothers. They went over very well last year. We had them there last year, and they went over so well that we're bringing them back again.
Great.
We know they all do good work.
Yeah.
You know, all the bands that we hire, it's like we do have discussions, you know, rather informally, but we do kind of go through possible lineups, who we definitely want. And
I was going to ask about that. You must have to say no to some buddies sometimes.
Yeah.
Sometimes. It's a business, you know.
Sure, of course.
The bottom line of it is a business. And in the business of music, you want to see how many rear ends you can put in seats.
I understand.
You know, and that's the sad part about the entertainment business, but that's the bottom line.
Well, my wife's brother lives in Shepherdstown, West Virginia, and he took us down to Monticello one time, and which I gather is kind of roughly in that same area, right?
It is.
Near Charlottesville, and boy, that is some beautiful part of the world.
It is. I mean, you guys have it beautiful right here in the Yukon, but we're very proud of our little Shenandoah Valley also, and I've had people that tell me that when they come to the festival, it's worth the admission just to sit beside the Murray River and gaze upon the Blue Ridge Mountains
and watch the
sunrises and stuff in the morning.
That hardwood forest is something else, especially coming from here.
It's a beautiful area.
Yeah, great. Okay, I know that we talked about this a little bit, but you've paid tribute to the work of the Country Gentlemen and the Seldom Seen. Talk about their influence. What is it about these bands that are so important to you?
Well, you know, when I was starting to play music and I heard the Country Gentlemen, that was what I liked, you know. I enjoyed Charlie's vocal because I could understand every word that he sung, and
of course
I enjoyed their choice of material.
Okay.
I'm just gonna be flat honest about myself. I'm not a huge fan of the real early bluegrass music. I mean, I'm a fan of the tradition of it and what it did for the music to grow.
Okay.
But as any individual, you find things that you like, and I loved the Country Gentlemen.
Okay.
And from the Country Gentlemen, the Seldom Seen, Hot Rise, you know, all these groups, it was, you know, it really stuck in my head. I mean, I didn't get to travel to concerts. My family, I mean, how I learned to play was playing along with cassette tapes and 33 record albums.
Okay.
You know, I saved up my allowance and bought a big stereo system for my bedroom, and I wore that out in 2 years, pushing rewind and play, because I played with some of the best back in that day, you know, because I played
in your own room.
Oh, that's right, boy. I've had the Country Gentlemen. I picked right along. John Duffy, I mean, you know, I thought that was the greatest stuff in the world, so I couldn't believe it. And then later on in my career, Charlie Waller recorded a song I wrote, Heaven Got an Angel.
Okay.
And that still gives me goosebumps to think about that, because here's my idol recording a song that I had written.
That is pretty special.
From that moment, I got to meet him, and he and I became close friends, and found out later he was a huge fan of Nothing Fancy.
Isn't that terrific?
He gave us one of the best compliments that we'll probably ever receive. Actually, the weekend before he passed away.
It was his last show.
His last show. He was on stage. When he went on stage, he said, ladies and gentlemen, he said, I don't know if you've listened to that band, Nothing Fancy, but he said, they are what the country gentleman used to be.
Wow.
And we were sitting there. We were in the audience. We just about sunk into the chairs, you know. But,
of course.
He was a dear friend and such a true talent and very optimistic. You know, we went to him when we were deciding to do this as a business and stuff, and he said, Charlie, you know, he said, everybody wants to say you can't make any money in bluegrass music. Charlie said, well, that's bull.
Yeah.
If you want to make money, if you want to make a living playing music, you can do it. And he said, it's a business.
Runner. I think I read that he was 47 years with the Country Gentleman.
Yeah.
That is incredible.
And just go back through his music and just listen to how the sound. And I don't know how bands do that. I'm thinking Nothing Fancy to the era of doing that. He carries that sound through those 47 years. You can hear a song in the distance playing on a radio and know that it's a country gentleman song.
And I remember when I was a kid, you know, when growing up around, Dad played bluegrass all the time and the trucks and various cars that he owned through the years. And there was that one guy with that real distinct voice that, you know, didn't sound like anything else on the radio. And I always wondered who that was.
Yeah.
And I didn't know for years and years and years. I had no idea. I just never asked my dad, who's that guy with that really awesome voice? I should have probably said that. But years later, you know, I'm traveling down the road with these guys and they're talking about the Country Gentleman. And I remember the band name Country Gentleman. I was like, oh, that's the guy with that really cool voice.
Sure enough.
Well, then I go to Spigma one year, and this is the same year that, you know, he learned that song from me. I find myself going to the elevator. I'm coming downstairs to the lobby of the hotel where all the jams are. And this gentleman steps onto the elevator with me. It is Charlie Waller.
Wow.
And I don't know what to say to him. I was like, hello.
Yeah.
Welcome aboard the elevator. Which floor, sir?
Yeah.
You know, I feel like I feel like that elevator operator guy. Just,
right.
I'll push your button for you. There you go.
Right.
So, yeah, Charlie was a big influence pretty much on all of us. And then you talk about the Seldom Scene. You take that album Live at the Cellar Door. And when you're 14 years old or 13 years old and you hear that album, if you don't like that and can't get that feel of what a live bluegrass show is all about, then something's wrong with your hearing, because that album, you can't help but laugh and enjoy. There's one woman that screams after every song, and she has the same scream, you know, and I picked that out right away from that album. I thought these guys were having the time of their life on this stage, and here it is. It's recorded, and I'm listening to it, and, you know, Ben drops his thumb pick on the one song, and they just keep on playing while he's bending over and picking it up, and you can visualize it.
Okay.
And,
you
know, Starling's
there. You're there with him in the room.
Like, that's a 50-cent shot there, buddy, or
right,
something, you know.
Right. Yeah.
So that, you know, the Seldom Scene was
Duffy
right
calling
there.
Aldridge his legend ship.
Yeah.
Okay.
Various times his legend ship here.
Okay. Caleb, how about you? Who are big influences on your play?
Well, you know, I came up in a little bit different era.
Sure.
As far as the evolution of the music when I was coming up, my parents were always really big on Alison Krauss.
Okay.
So I grew up listening to her, same kind of thing like with, you know, Chris riding around in the truck with his dad listening to Country Gentleman.
Yes.
I was usually listening to Alison Krauss.
Right.
And I think my first bluegrass show that I ever went to, that was really all I knew about bluegrass up to that point, aside from just really old stuff. My grandpa listened to a lot of Jim and Jesse McReynolds.
Of course, yeah.
Who are some of my idols now.
Okay.
You know, I listen to them all the time. But I went to see, I think it was Third Time Out.
Okay.
At the Appomattox County High School when I was young. I barely remember the show, but I do remember it. And just thinking, wow, this is the coolest thing ever. And I got into Third Time Out and some of the older Doyle stuff.
Okay.
And things kind of that era, the original Lonesome River Band.
Okay.
was a huge influence.
Were you playing at that point?
Yeah. I'd really just started to get into bluegrass like a lot.
Okay.
And doing it all the time. So I did like Mike did. I'd spend all my allowance on CDs and, you know, different tapes and everything I could find.
CDs, not cassettes.
Cassette tapes. Yeah. It was CDs then. I remember I asked for a CD player for Christmas for years, and like 3 or 4 years in a row, and I finally got it. And from that point on, I just bought CDs, all I could buy, you know, of all that old stuff. And I kind of got away from it for a little while and got where I was listening to the more modern stuff.
Okay.
And
acoustic music?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
More acoustic, more like, you know, the Punch Brothers.
Okay, yeah.
Newer, kind of out in left field, stuff like that. And then the more that I play music, the more I keep going back to that older stuff.
Isn't that interesting?
I keep going back to it. And now that's all I listen to. Like, I don't hardly listen to music if it came out after 1975.
No kidding?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
So I'm kind of going in the opposite. You know, I started off listening to the new stuff and working my way back. Right.
Right.
I don't really think that's a bad thing.
Because, no, that's a really good thing.
Caleb impresses me all the time. It's like his brain can get bored with a certain break on a song, and the next weekend we go out, he's got something totally redone, whether it still matches the melody, it still carries everything, but you can tell that it's a little bit new to him, so it's exciting. So he's probably coming from this newer stuff and says, wait a minute, I heard this old lick here, I'm going to throw that in with it. And,
right.
You know, very cool.
And
he always knows he's up to something. He's got that little twinkle in his eye to let you know, I'm about to mess up your world.
The only thing we rehearse when it comes to our shows is the songs itself, just to familiarize ourselves before we go on stage, and the rest of the antics and everything that goes on is not rehearsed.
Okay.
That's why I have all this gray hair in my beard right now. But
what are they going to do now?
Exactly. If you come to one of our live shows, which I encourage people to do, try to sit as close to the stage as you can and watch what goes on, because you'll see the look of fear in our eyes sometimes, the laughter of panic. Idiots sometimes.
Panic.
You know, panic, the sadness of whatever sometimes. But the bottom line, the music's great, and the entertainment factor is always going above the limits. You know, it's just amazing.
Terrific. Well, I listen to some of your music on Spotify, and I know this is kind of a love-hate relationship bands have with the streaming sites. So tell me your opinion on that.
You know, I don't mind that at all. I think any and all ways that we can get the music out there, it will pay you back in the long run.
Okay.
The Grateful Dead had a great look on that when they encouraged people to video and
trade
film
tapes.
Their shows.
Absolutely.
And trade tapes, and look what it did for them.
Absolutely.
You know, again, it's what I'm telling you here is my opinion, but if it's like people, I walk around the corner and if I hear somebody, a little local band, playing one of my songs, you know, sometimes they look at me like, oh, I probably should have got your permission. Hey, that's an honor, you know.
Yes.
And in the world of bluegrass, I think it's an honor that these folks have a place to go, because 9 times out of 10, if they hear one of our songs on Spotify or whatever, eventually they're going to buy that album.
Right.
You know, or the
right.
album that song came from, because
right.
if it catches their ear and it gets their interest, folks are still nice. You know, a lot of people think that the world's gone stupid. It hasn't. There's a certain portion that has, but the majority still looks, say, wait a minute, I'd like to support that band. So they do want to buy the album and things. So.
And maybe come to a show.
And come to a show. Like I said, it's worth it to me if they hear a song or they get it free on Spotify or somewhere, but it brings them to the 16th annual Nothing Fancy Bluegrass Festival, September 22nd, 23rd, and 24th. It was well worth that. Thank you, Spotify.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the only way to deal with that, because it's not going away,
too,
right?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and there's you know, life's too short to be all paranoid about that
sort
of
thing.
It's
not going to change the big picture.
Yeah. Okay, well, we talked about the Bluegrass Festival repeatedly. So perhaps you can tell me what else you got coming up this summer.
Oh, my goodness. We got a full schedule from here on out. And, you know, I always encourage folks, again, to go to the website and check the tour dates, because they're being added all the time. Randy Graham is our booking agent at Graham Talent Agency. He's working now to try to we're looking at going to Germany. That won't be this year, but
right.
we're working toward doing that. I want to get some more tours like that under our belt. I love Canada. I truly do. Great fans up here, and I want to come back as much as we can. But again, you have to. I don't have the schedule right in front of me. I can't tell you exactly where we're going to be. We're doing the Sally Mountain Festival. I know here in a couple weeks. Yeah,
Jenny Brooks. Jenny Brooke, in a couple weeks. That's a good one.
In Vermont.
That's in Vermont. You've been before? In fact,
oh, yeah. That was my first weekend out with the band before I was actually a member. I played that wedding.
Yeah, he played a wedding.
After I tried out, they asked me to come play a wedding with them the following Saturday, and I did.
No, actually, the wedding was the first gig.
Yeah, the wedding was the first gig.
And then
Mitchell come up to me. He was like, want to go to Vermont next weekend? I was like, what? He was like, yeah, we don't really have a guitar player. You want to go to Vermont? It's like, all right.
I guess so.
And I just thought that was the coolest thing. I was like, wow.
That is a wonderful festival. It's called the Jenny Brooke Bluegrass Festival in Vermont. Tunbridge, Vermont.
And talk about all the feels, man. He hit, we did Wait a Minute, which we did that song last night at the church over here. But that was the first time Caleb had ever performed it with us. And we get to the end and the harmonies just blended and just... They're, like, everybody gave it. We hadn't even finished the set, and people were giving us a standing ovation.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. I mean, and we're like, you know, we're actually on stage high-fiving each other and wiping tears. And,
oh, my goodness.
That's the beauty of what we do is, like, you never know when one of those little moments will hit you. And you can either, you laugh out loud, you might shed a tear, you might just, you know, feel the goose pimples on the back of your neck. You know, something like that happens all the time. You can't beat a live performance. You can't beat it. You know, you can record songs, but recording them is like taking a photograph of somebody. It's not that person.
Right.
Because that person's always moving and changing. Just like the songs always evolve into something else. You know, the breaks will always evolve. The technique is evolving. Everything about what we do evolves.
Yeah.
But going back to this year and the things that are on tap for Nothing Fancy, we'll be touring Missouri and all over the United States. And another thing that's on the bucket list right now that I'm trying to get Randy to make happen, I want to play the Grand Ole Opry.
Oh, no kidding.
And we're going to try to make that work this year. When it does, folks, follow us on Facebook because you will know about it. Because, again, that's been on our bucket. We've played the Ryman.
From the hills.
Yeah,
we have played the Ryman Auditorium, but we've never played the new, you know, Grand Ole Opry, the actual over there. And, so I want to get that checked off the bucket list. Want to work that. Again, we're going in the studio June the 27th, 28th, and 29th. Where the goal is to have a new album out to be released September 22nd, 23rd, and 24th. Because I want to have it available for the festival.
I see.
That's always our goal, and it kind of gives the fan base something to look forward to coming to the festival. Hey, I want to get the new album.
Of course.
So that's fun.
That worked out great last year. Yeah. We had advanced copies. The release date was the official release date was October 30th last year. But
you had the product.
But we had albums for pre-sale. Yeah. At the festival, and you know, you could buy actual copies, and so I think that was a great strategy on the record label's part and on our part, because having it available at the tables so people could hear it and actually say, wow, this we really like this, and they got the word out about it. So by the time the album was actually released, people were like, they were enthused.
Great.
Really enthused.
A lot of good stuff.
We're kind of coming to the end of our time, and I know we've talked about this a little bit, but maybe you can give us an idea what an audience can expect when they see Nothing Fancy.
An audience can expect good music, good tight harmony, nice-looking bunch of guys standing in front of them, and a huge amount of entertainment. We take it seriously. We've won the award for Entertaining Group of the Year with Spigma 7 times, I guess it's been. We enjoy what we're doing.
Yes.
It's not fake. You know, I can sit here and talk to you about it for another hour, but if you don't come to the live show and see it, you'll never know what I was talking about. But we will give them their money's worth, and they will leave with a smile on their face.
That's fantastic. I want to thank you guys again for taking this time to speak to me.
Hey, Steve, I'll tell you what.
Thank you.
It's our pleasure.
Yeah, thanks, Steve.
Thank you so much, Steve.
Great. Thanks, guys.
That was a conversation between Steve Gedrose and three of the five members of Nothing Fancy. You can listen to the music of Nothing Fancy in episode 53 of Jam Live, where you will also find more music and interviews from the 2016 Kluane Mountain Bluegrass Festival. Check out our website at junctionjam.ca and just click on the Jam Live link. A heap of thanks to the Yukon Bluegrass Music Society for all their support. And we extend a hearty appreciation to Steve Gedrose for preparing and conducting the interview. This show was happily brought to you by Junction Arts and Music. Written and produced by Dieter Gade, and I am Maria Leniak. Cheers till next time.